Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Matters, the show in which I discuss all matters of the mind and in which I show how much mind matters. And once more, a very warm welcome to part 27 of Control Your Brain, Control Your Life. I am Udo Staatsbürger, I am live on air, and I welcome your calls with questions and comments as long as they relate to the subject I'm talking about. All other questions, comments and suggestions I will answer by email. I welcome your communication with me enormously because it is important for me to learn what you think about this series, and I also value your other comments and suggestions. So keep on sending them. For newcomers, just go to my website http://www.mindmattersonline.info. Mind Matters Online is one word. There you will find my email address and then write to me. I will reply as usual within 48 hours. On page 3 of my website and on the following pages, you will find recordings of all my radio programs for you to listen to at your leisure. Last week I spoke about feelings in general, how they are generated, and that we can control and change them just by using our emotion and our focus. Today I will continue talking about how to change your feelings and your states of mind. As I told you last week, you can change your state very quick just by changing your posture and by choosing a different focus. For example, if you are upset about something, step back from it emotionally, dissociate, straighten your posture, and then relax. Change the rhythm of your breathing to deliberately slow and comfortable. Instead of focusing on the problem, focus now on a solution. Or, if a solution is too difficult to find right now, focus on the easiest way out. This could be doing nothing now and delaying a response to a later time when you have created some emotional distance between yourself and the problem. It is very important to avoid knee-jerk reactions because they almost always give you an outcome that in hindsight was the worst possible one. When your mind is engaged focusing on the problem, you mainly focus on the negative aspect of it. When you focus on a possible solution, your focus changes to something positive, a resourceful state of mind. Many people focus always on negative outcomes. If you belong to this group and consistently focus on the worst that can happen, change this. If you cannot control your states, you cannot control your behavior. Not controlling your behavior does not let you progress and makes it impossible for you to change just about anything in your life. When you feel that it is difficult to change the way you think, and therefore it is also difficult to change your life, then this is what you are focusing on, and you will get what you focus on. If you think that you can still change in spite of your state, think again, you cannot, because you will always feel negative whenever you begin your exercises towards change. You feel negative before you even start your exercises, whilst you're doing your exercises, and instead of positive affirmations, you will probably make negative ones. First, you need to change your state and focus on the positive aspects of change. Create excitement for the endeavor you are about to undertake. Look forward with positive expectancy to the journey ahead of you. visualize all the stepping stones, all the small goals that make you feel good once you have reached one after the other. And see in the distance the big ones, the big goal, the one that makes all your effort worthwhile. The big one that contains everything that you are going to achieve once you have given your self-confidence, your assertiveness, the boost that is needed to create your self-belief, your motivation, discipline, and the determination to make it all happen. Visualize a picture, still or moving, that displays everything that your success brings along. Visualize the people close to you, for example, your family, and how they admire you for your success. Visualize all the rewards that success brings, whether they are of extrinsic value or intrinsic value. This will motivate you and strengthen your determination. You need to take conscious control of running your brain. You have to do it deliberately, or else you are at the mercy of the circumstances around you, and you will constantly react to them. To be able to do so, you have to learn how to change your state of mind instantly, at the drop of a hat, or even faster. You need to be able to change your state no matter what the circumstances are that confront you, no matter if you are afraid or scared, frustrated or angry. Practice it and practice it and practice it some more, not only when you need to do it, but also when it doesn't really matter, just for the fun of it, to practice it. Once you know that you can change your state quickly and easily, it will give you the knowledge that you can do something rather than cannot do it, that you can be courageous rather than fearful, and that you can be a success rather than a failure. This knowledge gives you tremendous power, more power than you can now imagine. The other skill that you want to practice some more is your posture, your facial expression, and your focus. Everything I spoke about in last week's show, and also what I'm going to say in this show. Establish habitual patterns of using your physiology and your focus so that you always feel good about yourself without putting any effort into it. After all, our prime motivators are pain and pleasure, to gain the former and to avoid the latter. Remember that all your feelings are only biochemical storms in your brain. They do not start on their own, but you create them by your own interpretations of what happens around you. You are in control over them. Therefore, as you change your interpretations, you change your feelings. As you change your feelings, you change your behavior. As you change your behavior, your actions, you achieve the outcome that you desire, and you create your own reality. To get to the bottom of how you can create your reality on a daily basis, you need to answer the question of just how do you think? Feeling good about yourself gives you pleasure, our prime motivator. Think about it. What is it that makes you feel good? I suggest that after this show, you sit down and make a list of all the ways that make you feel good. Make it a long list and make it a positive one. With this, I mean not to write down something that you need to avoid in order to feeling good, but going towards the positive things. For example, not feeling bored means avoiding a negative, whereas having fun means going toward a positive. Once you have made up this list, think about implementing a feel-good plan for every single day and implement the plan. Make a habit of feeling good. You are conditioning your nervous system in much the same way as you conditioned your posture and your focus. If you don't condition your nervous system, if you don't take control and implement your daily feel-good plan, you will not gain pleasure, but experience pain. In a previous program, I've told you that events and experiences have no meaning whatsoever until you give meaning to them. As an example, I gave you that an earthquake is not necessarily a scary experience for everybody. Yes, some may fear it, but others might say words to the effect of, "Oh, that's how it feels," and just feel curious about the whole experience. I know that I belong to this group because I've never experienced an earthquake and I really would like to know how it feels. Because people can have different emotional reactions to the same event shows us that it is not the experiences and the events that you encounter that make you the person you are and that shape your life, but how you interpret and evaluate these experiences and events. How do you interpret and evaluate without letting your upbringing and your background and your past evaluations and interpretations interfere? Well, by asking and answering your own questions. For example, you could question my statement that experiences are meaningless until you attach your own meaning to them. You could ask yourself, is this true? And then you consider your answer, and you will find examples from your own life that show you that the statement is true. For example, if you had a business failure and someone would tempt you into starting another business, you would probably be very reluctant to do so, because past experience made you perhaps fearful of going into business again, because you see yourself as a failure. But if you spend time on considering your position, you could also say that your past is not your present time, and that you had learned valuable lessons from your past experience, and that you can go into another venture, being a wiser and more competent person. We do ask ourselves similar kind of questions probably almost every day. However, your answers so far may have habitually been based on past negative outcomes, or what other people told you, or, worst of all, your answers may have been based on fear. If this is so, can you honestly believe that something will change without you changing your way of thinking and with it yourself? Therefore, in order to change the quality of your life to the better, you should change your habitual answers. These answers direct your focus, and your focus changes the way you think, the way you feel, your actions, and the results that you get from your actions. What do you think is the reason that so many people have no self-confidence, or have a negative and pessimistic outlook in life, or are constantly down on themselves and even in depressed moods? The only answer is that this is what they focus on. Their habitually patterned focus and evaluations seriously limits their emotional experience of life. They ask themselves questions like, "Oh, what's the use of it? Why even try?" And the answer is, "I can't do it anyway. Why is it only me who has to suffer? Obviously, I do not deserve any better. Why can't I succeed? Because I'm stupid. Why can't I find a loving relationship? Because people don't like me." In fact, I gave you not only stupid answers, but also examples of stupid questions. A question that begins with the word "why" seldom invites thought processes. It is much better to begin the question with "what makes me think?" What makes me think there is no use of it? What makes me think I shouldn't even try? What makes me think I cannot succeed? These questions invite you to think about the answers. They start thought processes. For example, what makes me think I cannot succeed? The first answer, without any further thoughts, could be still, because I'm stupid. But now you engage thought processes that can lead to the next questions. What makes me think that I'm stupid? Was I always stupid? Did I always fail? Now you can find answers that prove to you that you were not always stupid, that you did not always fail, that indeed you had quite a few spectacular successes, that you had quite a few brilliant ideas. Don't forget what I told you in a previous program about the thinker and the prover. You can think whatever you want to think, and the prover in your mind will find examples that you are right. Think that you are stupid, and the prover will go and find proof for it. 1 minute later, think that you are brilliant, and your prover will find countless examples that show you that you are right. Questions can change our focus immediately. If you ask yourself, why am I always so down on myself? On what is your focus? Surely on you being so down on yourself. What is your prover going to look for? Surely for the proof that you have every reason to be down on yourself. If you change this question to a very empowering, what can I do to change this state? You firstly immediately change your focus to a resourceful state, and secondly, you begin a thought process that will lead to the answer that you really want to get. Somewhat close to changing focus is reframing. I mentioned reframing a few times before in previous programs. Now I'm going into it in more detail. First of all, reframing and changing meaning are very much alike. You could also call it relabeling or redefining. It is all the same. There might be some purists who can detect some differences between them. But if there are any, they are so tiny that they are irrelevant for our purpose here. A very old Chinese Taoist story describes a farmer in a poor country village. He was considered very well-to-do because he owned a horse, which he used for plowing and for transportation. One day his horse ran away. All his neighbors exclaimed how terrible this was, but the farmer simply said, maybe. A few days later the horse returned and brought two wild horses with it. The neighbors all rejoiced at his good fortune, but the farmer just said, maybe. The next day, the farmer's son tried to ride one of his wild horses. The horse threw him and broke his leg. The neighbors all offered their sympathy for his misfortune, but the farmer again said, maybe. The next day, conscription officers came to the village to take young men for the army. They rejected the farmer's son because of his broken leg, of course. When the neighbors told him how lucky he was, the farmer replied, maybe. The meaning that any event has depends upon the frame in which we perceive it. When we change the frame, we change the meaning. Having two wild horses is a good thing until it is seen in the context of the son's broken leg. The broken leg seems to be bad in the context of a peaceful village life. But in the context of conscription and war, it suddenly becomes good. This is called reframing, changing the frame in which a person perceives events in order to change the meaning. When the meaning changes, the person's responses and behaviors also change. Reframing is not new. Many fables and fairy tales include behaviors or events that change the meaning when the frames around them change. The different-looking chick seems to be an ugly duckling, but he turns out to be a swan, more beautiful than the ducks he has been comparing himself to. Reindeer Rudolph's funny-looking red nose becomes useful for guiding Santa's sleigh on a foggy night. Reframing also appears in many jokes. what seems to be one thing suddenly shifts and becomes something else. For example, what is green all over and has wheels? The answer is grass. I lied about the wheels. Or, what do Alexander the Great and Smokey the Bear have in common? The answer is the middle name. Well, I know they are not the best jokes ever told, but they illustrate another aspect of reframing. Reframing is also the pivotal element in the creative process. It is the ability to put a commonplace event in a new frame that is useful or enjoyable. A friend of the physicist Donald Glaser pointed to a glass of beer and jokingly said to him, "Why don't you use that to catch your subatomic particles?" Glaser looked at the bubbles forming in the beer and went back to his lab to invent the bubble chamber, similar to the Wilson cloud chamber for detecting the path of particles in high-energy physics experiments. Arthur Koestler, in The Act of Creation, calls this process bisociation, the ability to simultaneously associate an event in two very separate and different contexts. In general communication theory, there is a basic axiom that a signal only has meaning in terms of the frame or context in which it happens. The sound of a squeaky shoe on a busy sidewalk has little meaning. The same sound outside your window when you are alone in bed means something else altogether. A light in a church belfry is simply that. But to Paul Revere, it meant that the British were coming, and also how they were coming, one if by land and two if by sea, the story goes. The light only has meaning in terms of the previous instructions that established a frame, an internal context that creates meaning. Reframing appears widely also in the therapeutic context. When a therapist tries to get a client to think about things differently, or see a new point of view, or to take other factors into consideration, these are attempts to reframe events in order to get the client to respond differently to them. I have quite often said that mind and body are completely intertwined and inseparable. What happens to our physical bodies affects our minds. What happens to our minds affects our physical body. So what happens in our bodies when we reframe? There are two parts to the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems. The two tend to balance each other through opposite effects. Sympathetic activation results in increased muscle tensions and the readiness to respond physically to some threat. There's more adrenaline, and the skin whitens as the blood vessels and pupils constrict. Parasympathetic activation results in muscle relaxation, flushing of the skin, dilation of the blood vessels, dilation of the pupils, and others. What we have been describing is that people tend to have sympathetic activation when presenting a complaint and considering the reframe. Then they shift to a parasympathetic activation when the reframe works, which is what you would expect to occur. If the reframing works, what was perceived to be as a problem to cope with becomes not a problem at all. The starting point of reframing is that every behavior has good intention. But is it true? Does every behavior have a good intention, even those nasty behaviors that we don't like in ourselves? The answer is simply, it doesn't matter if it's true, but it's very useful to pretend that it is true and that every behavior has a good intention. And when one deals with models, one asks, is it useful and not is it true? Yes, it is very useful to hold the pretense that every behavior has a good intention. It is useful because if you pretend that it is true, you can find a good intention and discover that the good intention can be satisfied by other behaviors. Then the objectionable behavior can be replaced by a behavior that doesn't have the unwanted side effects of the original behavior. In a nutshell, that is reframing. There was a woman who was a compulsive housewife who, whenever she saw a speck on her carpet or, God forbid, a footprint, she would feel bad immediately, and she could not feel good until she vacuumed every trace of the dirt or marks from the carpet. This woman had a compulsive behavior. She was a clean freak. She was a person who even dusted light bulbs. The rest of her family could function pretty well with everything the mother did, except for her attempts to care for that carpet. She spent a lot of her time trying to get people not to walk on it because they left footprints, not mud and dirt, just dents in the pile of the rug. I came across people who bought a carpet and then put plastic walkways across it, and people weren't allowed to step off the plastic walkways. They were also the ones who bought a piano and then locked it so that no one could play it because they didn't want to have unclean keys. When this particular woman looked down at the carpet and saw a footprint in it, her response was an intense negative kinesthetic gut reaction. She would rush off to get the vacuum cleaner and vacuum the carpet immediately. She was a professional housewife. She actually vacuumed the carpet 3 to 7 times a day. She spent a tremendous amount of time trying to get people to come in through the back door and nagging at them if they didn't, or getting them to take their shoes off and walk lightly. Have you ever tried to walk without any weight on your feet? This family, by the way, didn't have any juvenile delinquents or overt drug addicts. The family seemed to get along fine if they were not at home. If they went out to dinner, they had no problems. If they went on vacation, there were no problems. But at home, everybody referred to the mother as being a nag because she nagged them about this and nagged them about that, and her nagging centered mainly on cleanliness in general and the carpet in particular. Here is a therapist intervention with the housewife. What the therapist did with the woman is, she said, I want you to close your eyes and see your carpet and see that there is not a single footprint on it anywhere. It's clean and fluffy, not a mark anywhere. The woman closed her eyes, and she was in seventh heaven, just smiling away. Then the therapist said, and now you realize that that means you're totally alone and that the people you care for and love are nowhere around. The woman's expression shifted radically, and she felt terrible. Then the therapist said, now, put a few footprints there and look at those footprints and know that the people you care most about in the world are nearby. And then, of course, the woman felt good again. In the beginning, I said that every behavior has good intention. Did the woman's behavior have good intention? Yes, it kept her floors clean. Did it have unwanted side effects? Yes, it made her a sheer terror to be around in the house if you stepped in the wrong place, like on that carpet. When she came to see the minor marks on the carpet as a sign that her loved ones were around, the very same marks became a source of good feelings to her, and she moved into being a normal housekeeper instead of a compulsive one. Whatever you call reframing, whether it's relabeling or redefining or meaning changing, What you are doing is attaching a new response to some sensory experience. You leave the contents the same and put another piece of meaning around it, the same kind of meaning that you have already made. The clean freak mother makes a judgment that when she sees this sensory experience, it means something important enough to feel bad about. If you can define the sound of squeaky shoes outside your window at night as being something important enough to feel good about, then your response to it will change. What about confusion? Isn't confusion a problem? We've been carefully taught that to be confused is bad and that success is good. I also told you to question every statement. Now, is confusion really bad and is success always good? What about the statement that success is the most dangerous human experience because it keeps you from noticing other things and learning other ways of doing things? That also means that any time you fail, there's an unprecedented opportunity for you to learn something that you wouldn't otherwise notice. Confusion is the doorway to reorganize your perception and learning something new. If you were never confused, that would mean that everything that happened to you fit your expectations, your model of the world, perfectly. Life would simply be one boring, repetitive experience after a repetitive experience after yet another repetitive experience. I say yes to success, but I qualify it with the wish for some confusion in between successes, and also with the wish for hurdles and obstacles that challenge me and give me the opportunity to grow. Contrary to popular belief, most people do get what they want out of life, but what they want is just not worth having. They want a home, a family, a good job, and they get all that and feel empty. But just add into that bland mixture a couple of teenagers, and suddenly one has one's hand full, and every day brings a new set of challenges. One of the biggest problems with the empty nest syndrome is that when the children leave, they take their problems with them, leaving the parents with a boring life once more. A good measure of confusion is essential to add spice to life, rightly understood. Let us leave reframing for now and let us move on to the language of success. When I say language, I mean our communication with others as well as our self-talk, our internal dialogue. Words are cheap, so the saying goes. But are they really cheap? Words can be used to hurt or to heal, to attack or to defend, to insult or to praise. They offer hope or devastation. We can make our noblest intentions felt and our deepest desires known. Words can create feelings and emotions, and they can create actions. And with these actions, we determine our lives. Words are cheap? I don't think so. In previous programs, I have talked about verbal communication and the power of language. Let's see about the language of success and the language of positive change now. An effective selection of words to describe the experience of our lives can heighten our most empowering emotions, whereas a poor selection of words can devastate us just as swiftly. I have said so before that we can talk ourselves into depression and even suicide, just the same as we can talk ourselves into elation, enthusiasm, passion, or bliss. Most of us do not even think about the words that they use and choose them unconsciously, and by doing so, they ignore the power that words can have, power that can hinder and harm them or assist them greatly in whatever they want to achieve. Words are a vehicle for us to express our thoughts and to share our experiences with others. But you need to realize that words that you habitually choose also affect how you communicate with yourself, and therefore they affect also your experiences. If you fail to master words, and if you allow their selection to be determined unconsciously or by habit, you may be denigrating your entire experience of life. People with a poor vocabulary live a poor emotional life. People with a rich vocabulary have a whole range of colors with which they can paint the pictures of their experiences, not only to describe their experience to others, but also to themselves. To consciously control your thoughts and your feelings, and through them your lives, you need to consciously evaluate and improve your consistent vocabulary to make certain that it is pulling you in the direction you want to go rather than where you don't want to go. Here are some of my pet examples how not to use language. Are you one of those who reply with "not too bad" when somebody asks you, "How are you?" Not too bad? What's wrong with saying, "I feel good, thank you for asking"? How often have you heard somebody saying, "I hate my job" or "I hate my boss"? Would it not be more accurate to say, "I'd prefer if I had a different job" or "I'd appreciate if my boss was more considerate"? Hate is such a powerful negative feeling. Hate leads to murder. You surely wouldn't want to murder your boss. Use words like hate or rage and you raise the intensity of a negative emotional state much more than if you used more conciliatory words. You can reduce negative feelings by using appropriate words, and you can raise positive feelings by using the right words. For example, compare impeccable to well done, integrity to honesty, pursuit of excellence to trying to make things better, disappointed to underwhelmed, stupid to unresourceful, painful to uncomfortable, all right to superb, confident to unstoppable, strong to invincible. There are many, many more examples how you change the impact of your communication with others and, as importantly or even more importantly, the impact on your own thoughts and feelings. Words have the power to move us to action, to shape our destiny, give us hope, uplift our spirits, even change history. Language is a tool that, if used properly, can propel us towards the things we truly want. Equally, words can be used to hurt us, crush our resolve, suck our energy, and weaken our conviction. If used unwisely or without clear intention, language can keep us stuck, away from the things we want the most. Have you ever reflected and noticed how you use your vocabulary to empower or disempower yourself and others? Have you realized that the words you constantly use have a much larger and deeper impact on your life, greater than you have ever realized? Have you ever noticed that there's a massive difference between the language losers use compared to the language achievers use? Observe your friends, family, and colleagues and pay close attention to the language patterns and see what you notice. I noticed that losers tend to speak a language that conveyed fear, uncertainty, and insecurity. They have the tendency to dwell more on what's not working, often complaining, moaning, fault-finding, worrying, apologizing, and making excuses. They use words that voice doubts, insecurities, fears, problems, and frustrations. If you told them about a plan you are working on, they would give you countless reasons and tell you of potential barriers that would cause you to fail. They choose to keep themselves small, and then they work hard to keep others small too. Whenever they meet successful people, they feel threatened, clam up, and avoid interacting with them. On the other hand, truly successful people tend to speak a language that is rich with certainty, confidence, enthusiasm, and sincere optimism. They often speak about what's working well for them, and they couldn't help but suggest ways how it could work for you too. They talk with excitement about their latest projects. They share the updates on the big hairy goals they are currently moving towards. They also share their knowledge, so they tend to talk about things they learned recently. If you told them about a plan you are working on, they tend to dwell more in encouraging you and supporting you to help you succeed. They are thrilled to hear about your attempts to grow and to stretch yourself. I had a client who wondered why the man she met never took her seriously, or why men always treated her as a sex object and nothing more. She told me about her life and what she did with it. She told me about her interests and activities and her social life. By talking to me about it, she eventually realized that because her interest revolved around shopping, traveling, watching TV, clubbing, and eating out, she felt she didn't have anything remarkable to talk about. So she resorted to talking about sex all the time, especially when she was nervous and trying to impress others. Because of the signals she was giving, men thought she was only after sex and nothing else. So they treated her according to this paradigm. The language you use works like an advertisement. The types of people we will attract into our lives and how they will treat us will depend on the type of language we speak, because this will shape their concept of who we are and how they will perceive us. I have just realized that I'm gradually running out of time. However, I will continue next week talking about the language of success and the language of change. For now, this is the end of this show. As usual, I would love to hear comments and suggestions about this show and the others before it. I will also answer any questions you have, and if you have any problem you want to let me know, I am happy to give you my best possible advice. Just go to my website, mindmattersonline.info, and write to me. Mind Matters Online is one word. I very much look forward to hearing from you. On page 3 of my website and on all the following pages, you will find recordings of my previous shows for you to listen at your convenience. Thank you for listening. For now, I leave you with words by Buddha, and I quote, "Whatever words we utter should be chosen with care, for people will hear them and be influenced by them for good or ill." Unquote. Tune in again next week, same day, same time. Goodbye.